update on what this bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm Director of Indigent Defense Services Division, and I appear before you today on behalf of the Public Defense Services Commission, as well as the Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. The Chair of the Commission, Barnes Ellis, unfortunately was unable to attend today. I have submitted written testimony. House Bill 2074 was pre-session filed and introduced at the request of the Public Defense Services Commission. The Judicial Department, from which Indigent Defense will transfer, it appears now July 1 of this year, joins the Commission in support of the bill's passage, and there is no known opposition, Mr. Chair, to the bill. House Bill 2074 is an omnibus bill that includes housekeeping and generally minor substantive changes that the Commission has identified over the course of the interim to be made to the enabling legislation from the last legislative session, Senate Bill 145. In addition, House Bill 2074 includes amendments to current law that the House Judiciary Committee and the Commission agree will further improve the public defense system. Mr. Chair, I provided detail with respect to what the sections of the bill does, and what I will attempt to do rather than reading the testimony is highlight the major changes that the bill makes. Number one, the composition of the current Public Defense Services Commission. Two changes are made by the bill. One, it would allow a senior judge. That's a judge who has retired but continues to provide pro tem services to serve on the commission. The second change is that an individual who receives compensation from the Public Defense Services account would be prohibited from serving on the commission. The second primary changes deal with statutory changes that mirror statutes that exempt the Judicial Department from certain statutory provisions. And the Public Defense Services Commission, as enacted, was kept within the judicial branch of government. And so the amendments detailed in Section 2 of my written testimony simply mirror those statutory provisions that exempt the Judicial Department from certain provisions. It also, the bill also provides for the Commission to enact policies, procedures, guidelines, and standards rather than rules due to the fact that the Commission is not subject to the APA as far as rulemaking. Another substantive change is that under current law, the Executive Director, Mr. Ozan, is required to submit an annual report to the Legislative Assembly. House Bill 2074 changes that to a biennial report, but keeps intact the fact the Executive Director must file an annual report with the Commission. In addition, there are changes to the bill, amendments that were made as a result of hearings before the House Judiciary in February. And those amendments are covered, Mr. Chair, under Section 3 of my written testimony. And one of those changes is to provide for the Public Defense Services Commission to provide for a peer review system with regard to certain non-attorney pre-authorizations of expenses, and those would be in aggravated murder and Measure 11 cases. It also provides for judicial review of administrative disallowances of billings. This is actually one of the requests that the Commission rather than House Judiciary made. Mr. Jim Nass, who's legal counsel to the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court, pointed out that there does need to be a provision for if the Executive Director, for example, denies a billing that an indigent defense provider submits, there needs to be a provision for judicial review, and that is included in House Bill 2074. Getting back to the House Judiciary amendments, in addition to the peer review system, the Commission will adopt a formal complaint process that allows district attorneys, criminal defense attorneys, and the public to file complaints concerning public defense payments. And this one in particular I'm especially supportive of. And another provision would allow for the contracting by the commission with out-of-state expert witnesses only in the event that in-state witnesses, experts, are not available or are more expensive than out-of-state. And finally, House Bill 2074 codifies that which my division currently does. It provides that the disclosure of the total amount of monies expended in an indigent defense case can be provided to the district attorney at the conclusion of the case. And the final provision, which is something I as well requested and the House Judiciary Committee agreed, is that there are a number of provisions that limit the courts with respect to the number of attorneys who a judge may appoint to a particular case. It's rare but disturbing when a defendant, generally it's in cases where the defendant at least appears to have mental health issues, requests multiple withdrawal and substitution of new attorneys. And so House Bill 2074 puts the power really with the commission to adopt rules that restrict the judge's ability to appoint multiple sequential attorneys. And those are the highlights, Mr. Chair. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Any questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Good morning, and thanks for testifying. How does that peer review process work?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ringo, currently, with respect to, I'll call them unusual requests for non-attorney expenses, I will consult with a handful of experienced, generally death penalty attorneys who, number one, are experienced, and number two, who are cognizant and aware of the limited resources that the Public Defense Services account has. So I envision the commission appointing a committee to review aggravated murder and ballot measure 11 cases. That committee may be comprised, say, of five of these experienced, well-respected attorneys. And the commission has not yet decided exactly how it will adopt this procedure.
But let's just say then you've got that peer review committee of five attorneys, just as an example, and an attorney makes a request for a certain forensics expert from out of state, and the committee would determine whether that's a reasonable request, whether that person can't be found in state, whether it's critical to the defense, and make the evaluation and then approve that expenditure.
That's correct.
Okay.
All right, other questions?
Thank you.
No other questions? All right. I have to put a lot of time into this. You're the only one to sign up, Ann. That's kind of nice to be able to speak before a non-controversial, seemingly non-controversial bill. So,
well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did want to say how much I really do appreciate all the time that the House Judiciary took at the beginning of the session with regard to issues such as the appointment of counsel, the breadth of the right to counsel, and also the non-attorney expenses.
Right.
It was good for all.
All right. And I assume the district attorneys, if they weren't happy, would be in the room.
Mr. Chair, my understanding, I spoke with Lane County District Attorney late Friday afternoon, and he had intended to have a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee, but he had not drafted it yet. My understanding is the Oregon District Attorneys Association is supportive of the bill.
All right. Thank you very much. And we won't hold that to you, just in the event that a letter comes out saying something contrary. I'm saying I won't hold you to your comments in the event that Doug sends if he sends something contrary to it, we won't hold you to it. All right, committee, the work session.
Chair.
House Bill 2074 engrossed.
I move House Bill 2074 to the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2074 engrossed unamended by this committee to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? There's no objection. And Senator Burdick, would you please? Thank you very much. And you're here on some more. Let's see. 2638.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Ann Christian, Director of Indigent Defense Services Division. I'm appearing for everyone but myself, I think, today. On House Bill 2638, I'm appearing on behalf of the Public Defense Services Commission and Mr. Ozan with regard to the issue of appeals, if you will, judicial review from parole decisions that are adverse to the person wishing to be paroled. And House Bill 2638 is a simple bill. It's a bill that we felt was necessary to clarify legislation from the last legislative session, House Bill 2348. House Bill 2348 provided for a change in the manner in which parole appeals were handled. Prior to 2001, an individual who was not happy or satisfied with the Board of Parole's decision not to parole the individual could file a petition for writ of habeas corpus in the circuit courts of this state, to which the individual had a right to appointed counsel if the person was indigent. If the individual lost his case at the circuit court level, that individual was then entitled to appeal that circuit court decision to the Court of Appeals. What House Bill 2348 did is provided for direct appellate review from the Board of Parole. It shortened the number of steps that an inmate could go through. We realized that House Bill 2348 did not make it expressly clear that only those individuals who are determined to be, quote, financially eligible for court-appointed counsel could have benefit of the Office of Public Defense Services representing that person on appeal. And House Bill 2638 makes that clear and also makes clear that the Public Defense Services Commission is the entity which decides whether or not a person is eligible for court-appointed counsel. It then provides for an individual who is denied court-appointed counsel an opportunity to appeal that decision to the Court of Appeals. And that's all that the bill does, and I, again, would be happy to answer any questions.
How do the Oregon Justice of Peace Association, how do they feel about it?
Mr. Chair, this was a bill that we searched for in an attempt to find a bill with a relating clause that would allow the amendments that the Office of Public Defense Services was seeking. And those amendments were broader than what you have before you today. The original request of the Public Defense Services Commission was to... It's very, very complicated, and I don't understand it 100%, but under House Bill 2348, there's a motion practice that has to occur on these parole appeals, and the Public Defender's Office has found it cumbersome and difficult, and the original amendment to this Justice of the Peace Bill would have modified that motion practice because of the fact that the Department of Justice apparently did not join Mr. Gartland and Mr. Ozan in that part of the amendment. The bill was made more simple and is, as I've testified, it is today. Otherwise, we could have simply put this provision into the bill I just testified on, House Bill 2074.
Right. Just out of curiosity, does this... Well, I guess I should say, are there not very many cases out there? Because I was wondering whether this needed an emergency clause or not. It doesn't have one, but I assume you're fine with that.
Mr. Chair, I noticed that this morning, unfortunately. And the practice has been since 2348 for the Office of Public Defense Services not to accept a parole appeal if the person is indigent. So that has been the practice. We're simply wanting to make it clear in law so that if any inmate ever challenges it, we have a bit more backup.
All right. All right. Thank you. Questions? There are none.
Sure, I could answer. The Oregon Justice and Peace Association no longer needed this bill, and the House Judiciary Committee needed a vehicle to take care of this problem, and they were fine with the amendment, and fine with the bill being used as a vehicle.
Thank you for that. All right. Anyone else wishing to testify? House Bill 2638, work session.
Chairman.
Senator Purdy.
I move House Bill 2638 to the Senate floor with intact recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2638 and engrossed, amended by this committee, to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? No objection. The motion passes. And Senator Starr, would you carry that one?
I'll do that.
Thank you. Okay, where are we going now? Session on 2803. I think when we left, there was some disagreement over this, and I think we want Mitch Morrow, to come up and I think I sent everyone out to go chat about this and see if they can come up with some agreement. I understand we at least have some understanding. And then, John Powell, you want to testify too? You're signed up on. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on the wrong bill. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mitch Morrow. I'm the Assistant Director for the Institutions Division, Department of Corrections. Testimony is going around right now. A lot of it is similar to the testimony I provided before. There are changes to the testimony, but I will point out on the second page of the testimony, but I'll point out that this rental bed recommendation is simply for emergency purposes. I mean, that it's only going to be used after everything else in the state of Oregon that might be available to us is exhausted. So I just wanted to start out by saying that. But if you go to the second page, some of the concerns that were raised by the committee, I'll walk through these paragraphs here. Should the department need to rent beds outside Oregon for male inmates, we will use the following criteria. There was a question about custody levels. We only use medium and minimum custody inmate, medium and minimum custody inmates. They'll have more than 2 years until their release. We'll look at their conduct within the institutions to make sure there's no serious conduct problems. Ensure that there's no pending legal or court proceedings and no special medical or mental health needs. We'll also, when we develop the pool, we'll look to solicit volunteers first. And the last time we went into a rental bed program, 3/4 of the inmates that we sent out of state were, in fact, volunteers. We would take into account the inmate's parental status and his desire to remain close to his children when making our out-of-state assignments. And we'll also ensure that there's appropriate programs and work opportunities to the inmates that we send out of state. The authority to rent prison beds, again, is just simply to assist us in our emergency capacity planning. We, with the April forecasts, we are going to exceed our capacity, and so we need this option available to us if there are not county rental beds available to us in the state. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions by the committee?
Yes.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 8:30. It must be Monday. Usually I'm here by 8:20, but Mr. Morrow, I want to thank you and the department for addressing my concerns. Ms. Black had called me after our meeting and told me that you were considering making these changes. And I just can't tell you how pleased I am that you have done this, because our system of justice here is really one that's built on rehabilitation. It's punitive also, but it's based on rehabilitation and the need to send these people back in the community, because they go back in our community. And the proposal that you came to us with before was not going to achieve that end, I didn't think, and families would be torn apart and children would be at risk. And you know as well as I do that children of inmates are at extreme risk for becoming inmates themselves. So I just want to thank you so much for the department's willingness to listen to the concerns that this committee expressed and addressing those. And I can vote for this now, and because I certainly understand the need to address this issue and the safety of our corrections officers, but at the same time I want to make sure that our correction system is what it's built on and what it's supposed to be. So thank you. That's really all I wanted to say.
You're welcome.
Senator Burdick, would you entertain a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I also wanted to echo Senator Walker's sentiments, because I had some discussions with Claudia Black as well, and I found the department very responsive to our concerns and really appreciate it. So with that, I would move House Bill 2803 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bright moves House Bill 2803 and goes to the floor of the Senate. Do pass recommendation. Discussion?
Okay.
Senator Ringgold.
I'm going to ask a question.
Sure, of course.
Is the impact of... I have a feeling this bill's going to pass. If it didn't pass, what's the practical impact of that? We wouldn't let prisoners out. We would just have incremental more crowding.
It puts us in a position, Mr. Chair, Senator, where we do find ourselves in what I believe to be a dangerous level of crowding. Secondly, if we have to remain only in state and we used up all those options, the cost of the beds that might be available to us begin to skyrocket.
But we would not release prisoners. That's what I'm.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we would not release prisoners. That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? Any objections to the motion? There are no objections. The motion passes. Senator Walker, would you carry that bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Yeah, for a Monday, we're cooking with gas here, aren't we?
Yeah, I just got a note passed to me that it was actually Tuesday. But
for the record.
For the record.
Mr. Chair, I think so.
The work
session on 2113.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2113 comes to us from the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division. Restricts disclosure of child support enforcement information in order to comply with federal law. Clarifies the Support Enforcement Division is not prohibited from reporting child abuse by provisions of this non-disclosure law. Requires the Department of Human Resources to adopt rules consistent with federal regulations governing confidential child support information. Allows the division to disclose confidential information to federal parent locator service and to authorized persons if the information and enforce any state or federal law regarding unlawful take and restraint of a child, make or enforce a child custody determination, establish paternity, or establish, modify, and enforce a child support order. Ronell Schenkel is here to answer any questions.
Ronell, you want to come up and entertain us here? Is everybody happy with this thing?
Senator Walker's notes there.
All right. Senator Walker, your notes for the record.
On 2113, I don't have any notes.
Then I must be happy.
Must have been an early Monday morning meeting.
Right.
Oh, wait a minute. Here they are from 51303. Question by the chair. Oh, you had questions, Mr. Chair. It was you who had questions.
Mm-hmm.
And
now that I'm happy.
Yes, you had questions about our statute is out of compliance. or did they tell you the statute was out of compliance?
Right. I think I went into some diatribe about my consternation with the federal government.
Yes, actually you did.
Thank you.
And you said you don't like granting broad rulemaking authority, and I told Ms. Schenkel I wouldn't want her job.
Right. Thank you for the report to the court.
So that's the report.
Ronell, you're happy, right?
Chairman, yes, we are. And I have brought extra copies of the letter that was provided to you if the other committee members would like them.
Sure. Why don't you make sure everyone does get a copy of it? I think my concern was whether or not we were just constraining this to the compliance issues, and that's what your memo addresses. All right. We are in work session.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2113 to the Senate floor.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2113 goes to the floor of the Senate and do pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. Thank you very much. And Senator Farioli?
I will, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much. Let's do 2711, public hearing. Kind of the same line here, Ronell, you're back on deck here.
For the record, Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice. Representative Patridge hoped that he would be able to be here after his caucus meeting, so he may yet be able to join us. But House Bill 2711 is a bill sponsored by Representative Patridge and working closely with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support. It's related to our partnership with private collection agencies. Oregon has actually been noted, and we have been in the forefront, if you will, at the national level before Commissioner Heller several times for the law that the legislature passed last session related to this topic. Basically, what's different in Oregon from other states is that we have a statute in place in ORS 25020 that allows obligees, custodial parents, to choose the option of working with a private collection agency while they continue to receive services from the child support program. So that is the type of partnership we're talking about. It isn't that the child support program turns cases over to them, such as the case in other state agencies, but in fact we coordinate and work together to provide services to the family. What we discovered in putting this law together is while it is noted as the right way to go, we haven't had a lot of national companies come into Oregon. We haven't had any national companies come into Oregon, and we have learned since that time that if we were to make some amendments to this law, that we would have more companies providing services to our families here. Basically, the changes in the law proposed, I will walk you through them briefly. One of the pieces in our law from last session is a six-month condition.
Representative Patrick, good morning.
The six-month condition today is listed so that if an obligee signs up, the child support program will list the private collection agency so that the money can flow through them. However, we only do that for 6 months. After 6 months, we take them off the case unless the obligee signs them up again. That has been a hindrance to the way that they do business, and so this bill proposes to remove that six-month time period and instead says that at any time upon the request of the obligee or notice from the Department of Consumer Business Services that they have violated their rules, then we would remove the private collection agency as they pay to. Another change that is significant to the collection agencies is the fee cap that Oregon has in place. Last session, and I believe it was Senator Walker at the time, we went out and did some research at night on the internet and came up with a 20% fee cap. What we have discovered from a national report that was done since then is that the average runs more at a 29% rate, and in order to get some of the larger companies doing business in Oregon, we are seeking to raise the cap up to that 29% level. Another important piece of this bill is taking steps towards consumer protection itself. There are two provisions in here. One is that we would like to have the private collection agencies make it very clear in their contract materials that they provide to obligees what the terms and length of the contract are and any provisions related to penalties or fees if they try to exit from that contract early. The other piece you will see is rulemaking authority for the Department of Consumer Business Services. Currently, in Oregon statute, there isn't anything specific to collection agencies collecting child support, so they would put some regulations in place related to the collection of child support in Oregon. Those are the primary key changes. Again, as I mentioned, we've worked closely with Representative Patridge, and he, in fact, had a conference call with some of the companies, which I haven't mentioned yet, Representative, so I'll turn it over to him.
All right, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Rob Patridge, House District 6, which is Medford. Glad to be here today on behalf of House Bill 2711. Wanted to thank first the Department of Justice, specifically Rochelle Schenkel and Ronelle Schenkel and Cindy Chenault for their hard work on this particular piece of legislation. We concepted it last time, kind of grew out of something that happened locally in my district. Got some resistance last time. We worked very cooperatively together. I think last time we created a piece of legislation, I think, which is really, I think, worked out well. The Department of Justice has gotten some good recognition, as well as Oregon, as a result of this. The Department of Justice really has taken the lead in helping to be involved in these particular changes in order to, one, stimulate more collections in child support, and two, provide a high level of consumer protection. I know the 29% fee may shock the conscience of some people, but we would have been involved in conference calls and letters, and I think this committee may have been lobbied by the private collections industry. We felt, and I felt in working with the Department of Justice, that the cap level at 29% was a reasonable rate based upon the national studies, and this is really something that we'd like to see implemented so that more parents result in paying, and really that the money gets down to the kids, which is where it was intended. This is just an alternative method to provide some of these collection efforts. And the Department of Justice, as someone who has worked on their budget and chairs their budget committee downstairs, is very limited in to some degree in what they're really able to do. These private collection agencies can provide more resources in order to investigate really some of these hard-to-find child support cases. So I'd ask for your support, and I'm prepared to answer any questions, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late. We just finished caucus.
Question, Senator Fairwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Patridge, I think this is an excellent idea, but I have a question about who actually pays the fee. And let me try and walk you through this and frame the question. If there was $1,000 in arrearage and the obligee decided to hire a collection agent and they did, in fact, collect that $1,000, the fee would be $290 or 29%. How is that credited to the obligor's account with the Department of Justice?
I'm going to let the department talk about how they handle that.
Chairman, as Senator Farioli, if you had time to look at the law, you would see, and then further in our rulemaking, that the obligor gets complete credit for the collections or the payments made. Then the money is passed through to the collection agency so that they may take the portion of money from the obligee's funds that they assigned as a fee.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, that was the point of the question. It's actually the child that pays the fee. And I was just curious if you had Representative Patrick should explore the idea of crediting the net that reaches the child as toward the obligor's obligation.
I don't think that we have, frankly, explored the possibility that it would go towards the net. I think that these are very, very hard to solve types of cases. We're trying to get. This is like squeezing blood out of a turnip on a lot of these cases, and we're trying to get little bits here and there, and probably a lot of this money wouldn't get collected, period. That's the approach we took. I'm more than open to taking a look at other things too, but we're at the stage in the process where I think we're trying to move this piece and would be happy to take, and I think frankly that's not a bad idea to go back and look at next session.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that wouldn't create a problem because when the court imposes the obligation, I don't know whether or not they currently have statutory language or would have included in the order to put the fees in addition to whatever the obligation is. So you may have to go back and look at other statutes or mandate that courts add the fee on top of the obligation. beforehand, so I don't know that you could go back retroactively and do that very easily.
No, Mr. Chairman, certainly it's not the obligee's fault that the deadbeat parent isn't making those payments. It's not the child's fault either. And the intention of that judgment was that there be a net amount available for child support, and in there, and DOJ can't collect it, and it isn't getting collected in the Department of Revenue or wherever we send these things. So it just seems that the additional expense and hassle of getting the collection done is really created by the obligor, the deadbeat parent. And I guess I thought that they ought to pay the fee for the collection because they've created the problem. But as the chairman suggests, it may not be integrated. That kind of approach may not be integral to the system and may require bigger changes than you had intended.
Mr. Chair and Senator Farioli, they can go to jail now for not paying the fee, and they still don't pay it. So it's a very, very difficult thing. I would be happy to look at it, and I think an additive judgment is not such a bad thing necessarily in a case like this. But I think initially, based upon what we have, I think I'd be happy to look at that over the interim.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps that should be looked at over the interim.
We can add that to our list of things to do in the interim. Look at, I just love these family law things. Mm-hmm. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Patridge, thanks. And Ms. Shankel alluded to that. We beat this bill up pretty hard last session in terms of fine-tuning it and making sure that there were protections in place. And if either one of you could just briefly give the committee an answer to the question that I'm about to ask, which is, the department is not it's not getting rid of its own responsibility to go out and make these collections. In fact, you're very, very aggressive about that. But this provides an extra special ability, as Representative Patridge was indicating, to those very hardcore cases that are quite difficult. Is that not true?
Chairman, Senator Walker, that is correct, and I think you're recalling testimony last session related to that topic. It is often the cases where the obligor is self-employed, works under the table, does some of the types of activities that are harder to enforce without literal manpower out there to do it, and those are the types of cases we anticipate that while the department would continue to do all of its more expedited and automated collection methods, at the same time we could authorize a private collection agency to be doing some more in-detail types of enforcement.
All right, other questions? Senator Ringo?
Thank you. I'm just wondering, excuse me, if you can discuss what the 20% fee has allowed in terms of private collection agencies. Apparently national collection agencies haven't come in, but what about local ones? And has it worked somewhat at the 20% level?
Senator Menace and Senator Ringo, I would tell you that not really much has occurred because the rate is, frankly, too low. These are substantial amounts of cases that take substantial amounts of resources for collection agencies. Frankly, the national people who have the expertise in these types of collection efforts are not willing to expend the resources in Oregon with the 20% fee cap. I think that the department would tell you that's the experience. They'll also tell you, the department could also tell you about the experience that they've been able to communicate with other states around the country. That's why the department came back and we've talked, and that's why the 29% rate was the rate that we arrived at, which is the national average there.
Well, I'm wondering whether there did any local collection agencies pick up on this?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, I believe that Representative Patridge's constituent, who at one point in time was looking at doing child support, has since ceased doing so. To my knowledge, we've only, since this law was implemented, had one company that has come in under this statute and done partnership business with the child support program. In talking with the Oregon Collectors Associations, a lot of the collecting agencies in Oregon are not currently interested in child support. It is one of the harder things to do. The state, with all of our tools and remedies, often do the easy, so to speak, collections, and it leaves the more difficult ones that involve attorneys and judicial actions, and that's what the national companies are willing to do, but that's also why they have the higher overhead.
These national companies would investigate how people are receiving their payments, whether they are self-employed, whether they're getting paid under the table, and would actually conduct investigations.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, the way that the law is established is that first, once they had an obligee sign a contract with them and the obligee made the request to the program, they would not be able to take an action until they got, they sought and received approval from the child support program, from the assigned enforcing office, to say, yes, we've tried all of our remedies, they're not working, so now you can take steps. So they would basically be getting a report from us on what we've already tried and what is not generating collections.
But you do envision actual investigation as opposed to normal collection activity over the phone persuasion.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, the over-the-phone persuasion is exactly one of the topics of dialogue last session, which is why we gave the child support program that I don't want to say oversight, that gets my attorneys really excited. Why we will coordinate and know that they are taking actions. They may start with some phone calls, but they're likely to do some more in-depth investigation of assets, pulling further records, going into court, things that we aren't always able to do with our resources.
What do you mean going into court?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, they are probably more likely to go in on contempt actions than the program because they have the ability to dig deeper, so to speak, than we do with our resources to get the information to have a successful case. While the program does take contempt actions, it is not one of our most expedited enforcement tools.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Brady.
Thank you. Could you just go over for us briefly, Ms. Schenkel, on what the Department of Justice does to enforce child support obligations before you get to the point of a collection agency?
Chairman and Senator Burdick, that is a long list. However, let me tell you some of the primary tools used by the program in the majority of cases. Our number one collection tool, I would say, is income withholding. As most of this committee is aware, it's statutorily required in child support orders that are new or modified, and so that's our primary way of collecting support is through actual income withholding from an employer. We also do offsets of tax, both state and federal taxes. We do matches with financial institutions and garnishments of accounts. We do lottery intercepts. So there are a lot of exchange of information between computerized systems that generate administrative actions, which are more expedited than going through the court, as our primary tools of collection. We also have the ever-popular driver's license suspension program that this committee has heard for several sessions. And we didn't bring a bill on that this time, but that is another tool to get people to enter into payment agreements with us. If some of those more routine services do not generate collections, that's when we're likely to have an obligee saying, I need a collection agency as well. We will continue to monitor and run those other services, but they may need someone that can put in some more time on their case.
So, Mr. Chairman,
sure.
With the budget situation that we have now, do you see any risk that people are just going to, in the department, are just going to say, well, we don't have to spend as many resources on this function because they can always hire a collector?
Senator Menes and Senator Burdick, we have the Department of Justice budget up in the committee right now on child support. Friday was the hearing on that. We're continuing it over and going to hear it again this afternoon. We have assurances from the department, as a matter of fact, that they're not. Most of the money that comes in for child support collection is federal money. It's not state general funds, and so we're working with that and making sure that. Trying to make sure that nothing is hurt in the child support collection efforts that the state participates in.
I think that's pretty important because Senator Farioli pointed out the person who pays the fee is really the child in this case. So we'll be watching.
All right. Other questions? Anyone else testify? Work session. 11. Senator Burry.
I move House Bill 2711 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burry moves House Bill 2711 engrossed on the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? There is no objection. Motion passes. Senator Ringo, would you be kind enough to carry that one for me?
Yes, I will.
Thank you, sir. All right. Where are we? And Ronell's gone, right? Okay. There we go. 2381, public hearing, the DOC bill, I think. And we've got Mitch Morrow again, and then Mr. Powell.
Good
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Mitch Marr. I'm Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide support for House Bill 2381. The bill ensures the expeditious and orderly transfer of inmates from local correctional facilities to our intake center at Coffee Creek Correctional Institution in Wilsonville. This bill allows for the department to effectively manage the 350 to 400 inmates that we bring into our intake center each month, and the capacity percent for that intake center is at 93%. So it's very important that we work closely with the community corrections and folks to manage that. It's important that we ensure that intake staff are available to process inmates when they arrive, as well as ensure, again, that the bed space is available for the new arrivals. At the same time, I want to point out to the committee that the department is sensitive to the local jurisdictions in regards to if they have a special case that they need to transfer after hours or on weekends, that we help them out with that. We don't stick to the one-day notice and things of that nature in the bill. So we're very willing to work with the local jurisdictions. So I just, again, want to say the department supports this bill.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Powell for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've had it handed out to you a notice of waiver statement that local jails are required to have an inmate sign if they're to be transferred prior to a 48-hour lapse period. We really were unable to find out what the need for a 48-hour period was, either through communication with the Department of Corrections or through the sheriff's community. However, it is important to understand that almost all people who end up in the state correctional facilities are housed at local jails. And even the most or the nastiest of the nasty go through that as they go to trial, and they're held there. If you have to put this notice in front of somebody like that and ask them to sign it before they're transferred tomorrow, you get all kinds of feedback. Many times they refuse to sign it, and they have a day and a half to cause trouble, and they like to do that. So this bill simply removes the need, the 48-hour notice, requires the local jurisdiction to coordinate the transfer with the Department of Corrections, and makes for an orderly transfer system.
Chair, all right, Senator Burdick.
Does that mean that this waiver will be no longer used?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that is correct.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good thing because this waiver has kind of a fatal typo in it. It says proscribed period of time. I think what you meant was a prescribed period of time. Proscribed means a prohibited period of time. So I think the waiver itself had problems, Mr. Chairman.
You're starting to talk like a lawyer.
No, I'm a grammarian, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Okay. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I think that proscribed means prescribed to sheriff. That's just sheriffese.
Mr. Chairman, okay. I'm speechless.
Other questions? No other questions? Work session.
Thank you.
Senator Brady.
I move 2381A gross to the Senate floor with the recap recommendation.
Senator Brady moves House Bill 2381 A gross, unamended by this committee before the Senate floor recap recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. And I'll carry this one. 2350 is the last bill on our agenda today. A little public hearing on this. Sybil Hebb, you're first up.
Morning, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm a family law attorney with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of House Bill 3250, the A engrossed version. I'll just give a brief summary of the bill. It's designed to prevent international child abduction and does that by allowing a court after a finding by clear and convincing evidence that there is a risk of abduction to enter certain protective measures designed to prevent that risk. The risk of abduction is to a certain type of country, a country which is either not a Hague signatory or not a signatory to the Hague Convention on International Child Abduction, not a country that provides for extradition of one parent to the United States for prosecution, also a type of a country which may have restrictive local laws which would prohibit or restrict either the parent's ability to visit a child or the child's ability to leave the country after reaching the age of majority, or a country that would prevent or present a risk to the physical or emotional health or safety of the child, either because of a state of war or terrorism or because of some particular need or concern related to the specific child involved. If the court finds that there is clear and convincing evidence that there is a risk of abduction to one of these kinds of countries, then the court may enter protective measures which would include, for example, putting restrictions on the type of visitation, requiring supervision, requiring a parent to post a security bond, which could then be used to try to get the child back if there was an abduction, to offset some of those costs, which can be very, very high, or imposing certain travel restrictions on a parent, for example, turning over a passport or requiring the parent to provide a copy of the court's order to the embassy or to the government. In determining whether or not there's a risk of international abduction, the court is to look at three factors, including other factors at the court's discretion. But the three factors that the court must look at are whether there has been a previous either risk or threat or actual attempt at abduction of a child, whether the parent has engaged in activities that present or indicate a plan to abduct the child, and whether or not the parent has ties to other countries, familial, employment-related, other kinds of ties to another country, or whether the parent has very little tie to this country. That's the bill in a nutshell. This version of the bill, the engrossed version of the bill, was drafted in cooperation with the original proponents of the bill, as well as representatives from the Oregon Judicial Department and the private bar. There's no opposition that I know of or that we know of to the bill. I think the group involved recognizes that this bill goes only a small way towards preventing all parental abduction and that there are risks that are not addressed by this bill. However, given fiscal concerns and today's economy, we were satisfied that this was an important compromise and an important first step in addressing some of these concerns. I did have one point to note, which is that in Section 3B of the bill, the word or, it was recommended at the last hearing that the word or be changed to and, so that the court would be required to consider all three of those factors in determining whether or not there is a risk of abduction, and I note that that change has not been reflected in the engrossed bill, or it was pointed out to me.
Page 2, line what?
Of the engrossed, it is line 7, page 2.
The or at the end of the sentence to and, right?
Thank you, yes.
All right.
And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Sybil, tell me how would we have a list of these various nations that meet the criteria?
Well, Chairman, if I understand your question, how would we create a list?
Well, foreign country for the purpose of the bill. And it has certain things like has local laws or practices that would restrict us, et cetera. How's the judge going to know which one?
Well, I think the burden would be on the parent who is requesting this kind of relief to present the court with evidence as to why this country or there is a risk of travel or abduction to a country which satisfies these criteria. I don't think, if I understand, Chairman, this is your question, I don't think it'd be possible to come up with a set list right now, given that, of course, some countries may go to war down the line or these circumstances will change. I don't think they're a static set of circumstances.
So you're suggesting that this is an issue that would be brought up by some party in court that would then suggest that travel XYZ country should be prohibited in this law for the following reasons.
Correct, Chairman.
The burden would be on that party to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that that they met this this test, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Any questions for Senator Bernie?
I was concerned about the passport restriction because of civil rights concerns. But I see here it only applies to passports that are issued on behalf of the minor child or jointly for the parent. My question is, if those restrictions were issued, say, for a joint passport, I'm assuming that the person, the parent, would have, would still have the right to get their own passport, and that right would not be infringed on in any way in this bill.
Chairman and Senator Burdick, I believe that's correct. I'm not an expert on the rules that are used by the embassy to issue passports, but this bill does not intend, and I don't think puts any restriction on a parent's ability to get a passport for his or her own on his or her own behalf.
Other questions? There are none.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Council.
Ms. Hibb, I assume as it relates to the passport, there was nothing, the court would still have the ability to require a parent, say if the parent, you were concerned about flight, say the parent came from a Middle Eastern country that did not recognize the Vienna Convention, and it was a question of the parent having visitation, the court could require that person to surrender the passport to the court, could they not?
This bill provides, Mr. Taylor, this bill provides certain certain things that the court can do in order to reduce the risk of parental abduction. It does not, this list is not exclusive, so the court could determine another remedy that the court felt was appropriate or necessary in order to prevent the risk of abduction. So, for example, if a parent in that circumstance had previously taken the child to the country on visitation and refused to return the child, that may very well be the type of requirement that the court might impose in order to reduce the risk. It's the kind of thing that could be limited, for example, so that the passport was only required to be turned over during the period of time that the visitation was allowed and could then be returned. So there is some court discretion in determining how to handle that.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hebb, I assume I see Representative Nelson here and that this bill was sponsored at the request of L. Freeze or Freeze A. So I assume we're going to hear a little bit of testimony about why this bill is brought forward.
Thank you, Chairman and Senator Walker. Lillian Freeze is here today with her granddaughter, and I believe she's in the room. So.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Walker, you're here. You want to come up and...
Walker?
Sorry, Representative. You used to be Representative. Donna Nelson. Excuse me. It's
Thank
too
you.
Early on the Monday morning or Tuesday morning?
Monday, Tuesday.
It feels like a Monday.
It does. I think it's going to be a week. I just have no sense.
Chair Minnis and distinguished members of this Senate Judiciary Committee, I am State Representative Donna Nelson from District 24 in the beautiful Willamette Valley. I thank you today for your consideration of House Bill 3250. Arisa Tarabi was born at Meridian Hospital in Tualatin, Oregon in 1995. Arisa was a sixth-generation Oregonian and a U.S. citizen. Her parents were both citizens of the United States. In 1997, Arisa was abducted by her father and taken to Iran. She was abducted from her home in Tualatin. Arisa's mother and father had initiated divorce proceedings and were involved in increasingly heated custody discussions. Her father, a citizen of Iran as well as the United States, began issuing threats that he would simply take his daughter to Iran. Ultimately, those threats were realized. House Bill 3250 addresses a problem that is growing at an alarming rate. The number of international marriages is on the rise, as is a corresponding growth in international family abductions. There are enormous obstacles to obtaining the safe return of a child abducted overseas. Arissa's mother and maternal grandparents have expended huge sums to locate this precious child and were successful but hold little hope in securing her return. Naturally, they are devastated, as any of us would be. House Bill 3250 would allow Oregon courts to impose a fiduciary bond upon a person deemed likely to flee with his or her child. This would include people like Arissa's father. Arissa was the unwitting victim in this situation. She was ripped from familiar surroundings and deliberately kept from her mother. As has been the case with Arissa's father, the abducting parent often will provide a rationale for his or her, for that matter, behavior, including telling the child that the other parent abandoned her, gave her away, does not love her, or is dead. Imagine the damage done to an innocent child thrust into these circumstances. Once a child is abducted and removed from this country, the remaining parent faces an ordeal that, depending on the nation to which the child was taken or is taken, may result in a permanent loss of the child. United States law and legal enforcement measures are customarily rendered useless once an abductor crosses sovereign borders. Consequently, when there is a risk of abduction, it is critical to use every means possible to prevent such an action. House Bill 3250 is one of those measures. Bonds can be powerful tools in situations where abductors otherwise have nothing to lose by violating court orders. More specifically, bonds can prevent a parent who has nothing to lose economically by abducting from doing so. Additionally, bonds can be especially effective when collateralized with property of the parent and or extended family, which provides additional economic and social disincentives for abduction. Moreover, fiduciary bonds provide economic assistance to remaining parents in the event of forfeiture. The proceeds of the bond may then be used to cover the substantial costs incurred by a parent whose child was or is abducted when attempting to locate the child and secure the child's safe return. In this manner, bonds provide measurable recourse for a parent whose child has been abducted. Arissa is still in Iran 4 years later. She has no mother to hold her, to dry her tears. She begs for her mother to come get her. House Bill 3250 will protect other children like Arissa. Colleagues, I urge you to support this bill and the children it will save. And I thank you for your support.
Representative Donna Nelson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Senator John Menis.
Thank you. Any questions for the Honorable Representative from Yamhill County?
I hope that answers, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker's question of why this bill was brought.
It does, Representative Nelson. I appreciate your testimony today, and I was leafing through some of the other materials you provided to us. A letter from Nancy Hammer from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children indicates that these kinds of abductions have increased 50% over the last 6 years, or at least familial abductions, and that one study showed that on average, left-behind parents paid $33,500 to search for and recover their children. That's a lot of money. And as you just testified, that doesn't always result in the children being brought home.
Thank you very much for that comment, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker, I think you'll find when you hear Lillian Fries speak that they've spent over $200,000 and still do not have their granddaughter back. I need to point out that we have attached testimony from our House Judiciary Committee, which voted to support this bill on April the 9th. And there's one small amendment, if I could just ask you to accept, on page 2 of the bill, which is attached. And it's line 7. Page 2, line 7, the last word instead of or, we'd like very much to change it to and. And I might add that all parties involved in this amendment have agreed that and would be in a more appropriate word there. You know, when I previously spoke on the bill, I just could relate so much to this issue. As a parent of 8 assorted kids, adopted and birthed and foster and stepchildren, you know, they're just precious, you know, precious in God's sight and certainly precious in their parents' heart. And my mother, you know, always said, Lord, let me go first before I lose a child. And I think, you know, we are so impacted by different types of illness, and we read constantly about children with brain tumors, you know, losing their lives. We just had that happen in McMinnville this week, a little boy that for, I think, 13 years, or he was 13 years old, has passed away from a brain tumor. And, you know, to lose one when, you know, there's not a health reason, it's just vindictiveness, is beyond my capacity. And I feel the same way to as my mother did, you know, to lose a child or a grandchild through a cruel through cruelty, I just think is inexcusable. And I certainly hope you will support this bill.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony, Senator Ringo.
I did have a question. Thanks, Representative Nelson. Right now, there's a custody battle that's occurring. The court can impose a, I think it's called a status quo order, that says like a kid can't leave the state or can't leave the country. And maybe somebody else, a family law attorney, is the one I should be asking. But
okay, why don't we ask Sybil to come back up here then?
Okay. Okay. I'm just wondering, what are the mechanics by which, I mean, in this case, it was the father could not take the kid's passport, go to the airport, and leave the country. I mean, just ignore the bond requirement.
Well, I think Senator Ringo and Chairman, members of the committee, if a parent is not willing to pay attention to the court's order, then it's hard to truly prohibit the parent from violating. But if there is a security bond posted, then that amount of money may be used in order to return the child. And if you're asking whether the parent may just ignore the requirement to post the security bond,
well, you could have one circumstance where you've got a custody issue, maybe divorced parents, and one of the parents wants to take the child out of the country. The parent genuinely does intend to return and is happy to post the bond because it won't have an impact when the parent returns with the child. I guess the other circumstance, apparently in this case, with the Iranian situation, is where the father had no intention of returning and had no intention of bringing the child back. Despite what any court order might say, the child and parent are now in Iran, and it's pretty hard to impose U.S. justice in Iran. So how would the bond requirement, how would that play out? Wouldn't the dad in that case just have ignored the bond requirement, got on the plane, and landed in Tehran?
Senator Ringo, members of the committee, I believe that if a parent ignores a bond requirement, if a parent's actually in court and subject to the court's jurisdiction and is hearing a court's order and then ignores the bond requirement, at least that's a flag to the court that there's a higher concern than maybe they may have realized, and then maybe they may take
more severe steps in order to try to prevent the abduction, for example, by disallowing visitation or disallowing any visitation that's not supervised, or try to take other steps that recognize that greater need. If a parent is truly determined to disregard any of the court's orders, I agree it's very difficult to address that concern. And I don't know if the court can address those concerns.
Yeah. No, I think the bill makes sense because there are circumstances where there's uncertainty as to what the parent's true intent is, and maybe they might get to the foreign country and change their mind. But it seems to me if the parent's intent really is to go to a foreign country and not come back, they're going to ignore the bond requirement and just go.
Just the other thing to point out, Senator Ringo and members of the committee, is the court does have inherent authority under the custody laws to make custody determinations and parenting time determinations that the court feels are appropriate to prevent or to protect the safety of the child. So if there is that great risk presented at the outset, the court has the authority to deny visitation whatsoever if there's that great risk.
Could the court require that any passport for the child be relinquished?
Yes, and this bill actually would provide specific authority for the court to require that the passport be turned over of the child or joint passports. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Sybil. Thank you, Donna. All right, a couple of other folks have signed up. Matt Mead. No, Matt Mead. All right, thank you very much. And Lillian Fries.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad to see that Representative Nelson is up and around again, feeling better. Did want to make note of that. I am Rissa Tarabi's grandmother, Lillian Fries, and some of the testimony has already been said about Rissa, so I'll just kind of skip on down to the portions that are a little different. But I do believe that a fiduciary bond should be brought because it provides a cooling off period. And if there had been cooling off period and someone that was a third party brought in, that I think that it would have completely avoided Rissa being abducted. Ramin hated giving my daughter any money whatsoever. And when he would come for visitation and he had to give child support, he would actually throw it at her. So, I mean, money meant a lot to him. And he never would have done anything where he would have defaulted on a bond where my daughter would have ended up with the money for her own use or to go after to, get the child back. So, it really does take the personal aspect out of the conflict, and it places the abduction prevention at a business level that is a level that really needs to be there during a divorce. As an abduction attorney, the court ordered that Ramin turn over his passports, and this means two passports. He had an American passport and an Iranian passport, and that these be held while he had visitation, or the attorney held them. But this made our family uneasy because passports are so easily duplicated that it's almost irrelevant that you have these things. And when Diane, my daughter, went through Ramin's personal effects before she left him, she found the following. She found four green cards, two birth dates, two Social Security numbers, 4 to 6 name variations, two passports, and at least two different driver's licenses. And in many countries, and I think you probably heard it on the news yourself, that getting a new identity in another country or having several identities is just a way of survival. So it's, holding passports, and that is which was one of the main deterrents the courts used in our particular case, was just, he knew he could get around it. And Diane would like to have had the court order that visitation be supervised, but if visitations had been supervised at this time, I'm sure that Rissa would still be living with us today. But the courts feel the supervised visitation interferes with the child and the parent relationships.
Therefore, the judges infrequently give supervised visitation, and if they do give it, for a very short period of time. The family courts are flooded with cases, and they cannot be expected to create acceptable new options. So, anyway, and it is unfortunate that the method of supervised visitation cannot be developed where that it isn't so costly, but they haven't come up with it. And if so unfortunately, we have very few things to fall back on, and supervised visitation is not one of them that they is an option, actually. And our family, like Representative Nelson has said, has spent a great deal of time and money and a lot of heartache, ups and downs. And that we found ERISA, and Diane has spoke to her three times in the past 4.5 years. And each time she wanted Mommy, of course. And it is sad because Mommy isn't there, and Mommy can't go there. And so, unfortunately, and what's happened too is the courts gambled on ERISA's life, and ERISA is the real loser, the biggest loser of all. I'd like to add right now that this case, and I'm sure all abduction cases, cost the state of Oregon, the counties that they were abducted from, the police force, and the federal government a lot of money. Because they've had to go through the court process, warrants are issued, investigations are done. And even right now, I mean, we are still in the process of trying to get her back, and the federal government is spending money. So abduction is not a cheap thing that happens. And if one child can be deterred from being abducted through this fiduciary bond, which is not that expensive for the individual, it's worth it. Definitely worth it. Thank you very much. Is there any questions I can ask, answer?
I don't know that there are any questions. Looked like the little lady had something she wanted to say, so I don't know if she wants to testify. She's welcome to. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Freeze, who is your guest with you today?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Julianne, my granddaughter, who is the half-sister of ERISA.
Very nice to have you here, Julianne. I had one question, Ms. Freeze. I was reading through the information you provided from Christine Ullman, and she said that Oregon's efforts to protect our children will become a model for other states. Have other states passed laws similar to this, or is this
yes.
something new?
No, it isn't. There's many other states that have done it, and they're doing it just right now. So Texas is doing it. California has done it. This was a law that came off of the Illinois law. Or Indiana, and there's just a whole series that are going through the process right now.
Great.
Now, they might not be exactly the same as the wording that you have here, but they are in that order to use a fiduciary bond.
And you said that the federal government is still assisting you in trying to bring mm-hmm. your granddaughter home?
Yes.
Great. Well, yes. I hope you are successful in those efforts, and thank you very much for bringing this to the attention of Representative Nelson so she could bring it here and we could make sure that we protect these children. Thank you. And thank you, Julianne.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Julianne. Sybil, I have a question for you because it appears to me, based on the wording of the bill in subsection, starting on line 26, page 1, it says, in determining whether a risk of international abduction of a minor child exists, a court shall consider, but not limited to, the following factors involving a parent who is subject to the court or custody order. Then it lists A, B, or C, and the word or on 7 to me does not appear to be limited, since the language already says shall consider but not limited to. So that not limited to language would allow the judge to look at all of these factors plus whatever other factors the judge felt were pertinent.
Senator Minter, Chairman, that's correct. Our concern was more that we wanted to make sure that the court did consider at least A, B, and C. And not exclude B, not consider A to the exclusion of B, or.
Well, tell me why you feel a judge would not consider this and more if there was actual evidence presented that would indicate that the child was
likely to be abducted.
I think the court, Chairman, I think the court would consider other evidence in addition to A, right. B, and C, but we wanted to make sure that the court at least considered A, B, and C, and anything else that the court might find
but again,
appropriate.
Wouldn't you, as a family practice attorney, make those arguments to the judge? Wouldn't you do you submit a brief, or do you make them orally, or... Wouldn't you, I mean, frankly, I assume you would put a list of 10 or 15 pertinent issues.
Senator Minister, absolutely. We just felt that given that some people may be going through this without attorneys, likelihood is that most people will be having attorneys in dealing with these procedures because they're fairly complex. But we wanted to make it clear and make it sort of easier for the proponents to ensure that all three of those characters.
Well, I mean, I can make you happy with this and get the amendment. It delays the bill, but, I mean, there are a couple of things legally. You've got the words on line 27, the court shall consider. Mm-hmm. They don't have to do anything. They shall consider. Consider makes it passive and permissive, if you will. But it also makes it very expansive by including the not limited to language. So it seems to me that none of this is constrained and none of it's mandatory. The judge doesn't have to consider under the shall consider language any of this. We shall consider. So what? I considered a goodbye. There's no statement or requirement that they have issue finding of fact relevant to these three issues, A, B, and C.
Well, Senator Marinus, if a person were to be going through this without an attorney, do you think that factors A, B, and C, if the court was required to consider all three of those, that would make it easier for that litigant to understand what the types of considerations the court might look at were?
Well, the shall consider language is pretty permissive. I mean, the shall is delimited by the consider it word. I think, at least it's my opinion, and we make you happy with this and change the language, but it just seems to me that the whole thing is pretty loosey-goosey. Senator Burdick or counsel?
Well, just before the counsel, because I want to hear counsel's reaction to this too, I'm concerned about the changing the or to and because, you know, in order to get to item B, you have to, that requires some level of investigation. And I could see a case where you might have A and C, and maybe B has occurred, but people don't know about it. I just, you know, if there was a strong indication under paragraph A, I'm just not sure that the court didn't have the flexibility to issue an order just based on that. I guess on the substance, I would not want to tie the hands of the court in a case where it may be justified that one of these situations, even though it exists, might not be known, and that could be seen as tying the court's hands.
Counsel?
Chair, members of the committee, I guess I'm the person that caused all those problems because I simply went back after the hearing in the House and put the and in the wrong place and got the amendment. So okay. I guess I'm to blame for this, but Chair is right. Shall consider means the court shall consider it. Whether they do anything or not is another thing, but I'm the one that caused the problem. So,
all right, you're going to be here by whip.
I know.
50 lashes with a wet noodle and verbally admonished. Hey, let me ask you this question. Wouldn't it be better to, rather than get into this discussion about or and these relevant facts, and I agree with Senator Burdick, her comments, but to include a subsection D that would say any other relevant evidence that the court deems appropriate or some language like that so that you have kind of a catch-all?
Chairman and members of the committee, I wouldn't have any objection. I don't know if I speak for the group, but it seemed to me that the group was interested in allowing the court discretion to consider any factors that might be relevant.
Right.
We just wanted to make sure that the court at least considered these three factors.
But you seem to be arguing that somehow it's limited. I don't think the language is limited at all as it stands, but if what you're really trying to get to is the court would consider all of the arguments made by the petitioner or whatever they're called, than some other language that says any other relevant.
Chairman, I don't feel like this is limited. It seems to me that you're correct that the court can consider anything according to this language because it shall consider X,
and including but not limited to X. So it could consider as all the evidence that it felt was relevant. And to speak to Senator Burdick's question, it seems to me that the court could determine that there is such a strong showing under Factor B that it doesn't matter that there's not a showing under Factor A, or vice versa. My only concern, I think the group's concern, was that we wanted the court to at least ask those three questions. Is there a plan? Has there been a previous threat? And are there ties? And it doesn't matter. It's not required that the court find all three of those things in order to order protective measures, but we wanted those three inquiries to be made because research has shown that those three inquiries are, those three factors are connected to risks.
Yes, Chairman.
Senator,
I want to stop you right there. What you're saying is they're not required to make findings under all three of these things. Is that what you're saying?
Correct, Senator Burdick.
Okay, well then,
and members of the committee.
My concerns are relieved by that.
But again, that's my point. They don't have to make findings on anything. They just consider it.
Well, the court's required to make findings so that they can. The last section of the bill on line 25,
right.
Section 5, requires the court to make findings so that the parties are aware of what kinds of things the court took into account in making its decision. But the court's not required to make findings along each of the on A, B, and C in order to make its protective measure.
Okay. All right, Senator Walker.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm okay with the or because, as was just illustrated in the testimony, it can be either A, B, or C that the court finds is the problem here, and putting an and in there sort of gives you pause to think that you have to meet all three. But I understand what Ms. Hebb is saying, too. I really don't care one way or the other. Just think it's fine the way it is.
Of course, I kind of like my own idea here about a subsection. Well, and I think if you do take the 26 and 27 of the written findings of fact, that if the arguments made on behalf of the plaintiff or petitioner, that there are other relevant factors or evidence, then the judge would have some finding of fact that would be stated in the record as to whether they agree or disagree with that. So, I mean, you want to limit it just to the three factors.
Chairman, I don't want it limited to those three factors. I want at least those three factors considered.
Well, that seems like it's limiting it. Because what we know in this committee is that judges won't do anything more than what they're told.
I have no objection, and I don't believe the court would have an objection. I don't want to speak for the group. We've spoken to members of the Judicial Department and also Private Bar. It's my understanding that we felt like the court should be allowed to consider all criteria, at least these three.
All right, committee, where are we? Senator Ringo.
I mean, Mr. Chair, it seems to me, and I think this is what you've been saying, I mean, the court can consider other factors as it's written. I think that's true.
But that's what I'm saying. That's why you don't need an and.
Yeah.
See where it looks good.
Right.
Okay. All right. Do you want the bill as is, or do you want to stomp your feet and jump up and down and say we can make this change?
Which would you rather? I think I would prefer, and the group would prefer, what we talked about was having the word and there. And I...
Well, you're not going to defer to my judgment at all.
I don't know if I want to stamp my feet, but...
All right, counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, I also received a note from Matthew Medora. I guess when they originally printed the bill, they printed Ms. Freeze, they spelled her name wrong.
Oh.
Which means if we're going to get the spelling correct, we have to amend the bill.
And Mr. Chair, I think that's the answer right there.
All righty.
I hate my name being misspelled, so...
How can anybody misspell Vicky?
They spelled Vicky wrong.
We'll get changes to reflect the correct spelling of Lillian Freeze's name.
And we're going to bring
an amendment back to put the and there. We'll have further discussion about that.
And we're not going to add your sub B.
Yeah, I don't care. No, I was trying to help.
Well, if we're going to amend the bill, I say we add your sub D.
Well, what we don't want to do is have the Judicial Department go spiraling completely out of control, which they have a tendency to do. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if we are going to bring an amendment back, could we, you don't mind if I change the and to an or?
To fix the problem you created.
The problem I created.
All right. We'll expect you to do a better job this next year.
We could actually bring two. I like the idea of your subcommittee. We could actually bring two amendments, one to do the and or thing and change the name, and a second amendment to do what you talked about, just in case the Judicial Department gives up.
We can run it by the Judicial Department as soon as they freak out.
Okay.
Oh, here's another attorney. Things are spinning out of control already, I can tell.
I'm told that the Judicial Department and the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence don't have an objection to adding the sub D. So,
well,
Senator,
all right.
Maybe we can do it all in one amendment.
All right. Well, we'll bring back the various amendments and for a work session. All right.
Appreciate it.
Anyone else wishing to testify on this fine piece of legislation? None. Any further comments? Political diatribe, et cetera. There are none.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did we do those other two bills before?